Welcome. Part six of the history of Israel tonight, the 1930s, the Gathering Storm. As always, was sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yona ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Gathering Storm, of course, is the name that Churchill gave to the first volume of his study of World War II. It's the 1930s. The 1930s began with the Zionists further from their goal of statehood than they had been in 1920. Internal divisions in the Jewish world between the socialist Zionists, the revisionist Zionists, the old Yishuv, the religious Zionists, the anti-Zionists, the non-Zionists, prevented a unified front, which of course a pattern until today as well. Jews always speak in a multiplicity of voices, and therefore the message is always diffused. The Arabs only have one message, and over time, that message is heard much clearer by an audience because it's singular, it's unified. Arab nationalism developed, we discussed last week, not as an inherent quest, but to thwart any Jewish aspirations. And the British catered more to Arab sensibilities than to Jewish sensibilities for a variety of reasons. Many British politicians were anti-Jewish, anti-Zionist, and very simply it was practical. The Arabs were prone to violence, and they engaged in explosive bursts of savagery which shocked the conscience of genteel British politicians. Any colonial power just wants stability, and stability lay in placating the Arabs. Also, we noted last week that in the 20s, the demographics turned against the Jews because of the immigration restrictions that hindered only the Jews and not the Arabs. The Arabs arrived in twice the number of the Jews during that decade. So when 1930 began, there were 160,000 Jews in Israel, but there were less than 20% of the population. Now, this would change somewhat during the 30s as illegal immigration increased. But when immigration was effectively cut off in 1939, the die was cast. Basically, only Arabs would come, and only they had to be appeased. Now, the key struggle in the 20s and 30s was always over immigration. And the British, in the really essence of hypocrisy, had tied progress to Jewish statehood to a Jewish majority in the land of Israel, and then sought to preclude that eventuality by preventing Jews from immigrating. So then, as the circle completes itself, they justify themselves in abandoning Balfour because they said, well, the Jews hadn't been able to produce a majority in the land of Israel. Now, part of this was simply a change in government, a change in the leading party. Remember, Balfour was just a declaration. It was a declaration of Britain's foreign policy. Britain, again, it was later enshrined in international law through the League of Nations, but nonetheless, in essence, it remained British foreign policy. But that was conservative, Tory British foreign policy. Balfour, Lloyd George, Churchill. When the government changed in the 20s to the Labour Party had no interest in Balfour. In fact, they were more or less pro-Arab. Lloyd George himself noted in the late 20s, I quote, "The notion of artificially restricting Jewish immigration never entered the heads of the people making the policy. On its face, it was a denial of Balfour. It would have been considered unjust, a fraud on the people to whom we were appealing." End quote. And it was a fraud, but he was no longer in power. In the 20s, Lloyd George, in fact, was head of a third party, which was a power broker, but not really a power in Britain. And the Jews themselves were divided as 1930 began with an approach, how to deal with the British. One approach was Weizmann. Now, Chaim Weizmann was still the head of the World Zionist Organization, which had been superseded somewhat in 1929 by the Jewish agency, HaSochnut HaYudit. They became the super parliament of the Jewish people at the request of the British. And it was an agency or a super parliament that would contain both Zionists and non-Zionists, Jews from the land of Israel, from Europe, and from across the world as well. Einstein himself was a member of the first Zionist Jewish agency executive. The head of the Zionist organization would be given deference as the president, and that was Weizmann, and there'd be parity in governing bodies, but it never quite worked out that way. In fact, any attempt to make all different Jewish organizations gather under one roof is usually doomed to failure. The organization that becomes the most powerful or has the greatest majority, so they in fact want everything their way. They minimize the role of any other organization, which the organization soon drop out. Now Weizmann's approach, and he was consistent in this for decades, was to work with the British patiently. He was an Anglophile, was a British citizen as a matter of fact, and he just was patient. Give them time and they'll come around, even if he had to agree not to pursue statehood. Weizmann focused on building the infrastructure of the modern state. Commerce, industry, universities, the Dead Sea Concession, the Rutenberg Electrical Works, which changed life in the late 20s. Pinchas Rutenberg was a Jew born in Romny in Ukraine in 1879. He was one of those who joined the failed rebellion against the Tsar and was exiled, but he went to Italy and he studied there hydraulic engineering, and he founded in 1923 the Palestine Electric Corporation with the support of Rothschild and Churchill and Herbert Samuel. That later became the Israel Electric Corporation, which still exists. He finally built the first hydraulic power station in Naharaim on the Jordan River, and that changed life in Israel also. He founded the electrical works. He was the head of it. The major plant today in Ashkelon is named for him. But that's what Weizmann focused on, building the infrastructure of the state. Ben-Gurion had a different approach. Ben-Gurion, who as 1930 came, was really subordinate to Weizmann. He wanted to emphasize settlement, collective farming, communities, kibbutzim. Israel would be in the vanguard of a new world order, especially the image of the socialist paradise. He said, I quote, "Settlement of the land is the only true Zionism. All else being self-deception, empty verbiage, and merely a pastime." But it had to be in a socialist framework. The common bond would be the Hebrew language, but the religion would really be socialism. So we noted last week his power base became the Histadrut, not only as a trade union, but also as an instrument, or mainly an instrument of settlement and commerce, a major land and property owner. But he wanted to settle the land, so immigration was important to him, but it had to be immigration of a certain type and building of a certain type in order to create the type of state that he wanted. It's the third approach, and that was Jabotinsky's, who was single-minded in his focus, and that was immigration. Only Jews would build a Jewish state. He became obsessive of this during the 30s because of the problems in Europe. Jabotinsky didn't trust the British at all, in that he was right. He didn't much trust Weizmann or Ben-Gurion either. And he also knew that the Arabs would never agree. In this, he differed from Weizmann, who was very favorable and assumed that the Arabs would welcome the Jews, as we've noted. But even Ben-Gurion saw the Jewish presence in Israel as a boon to the Arabs that they would accept. Jabotinsky knew they'd never accept, and he knew it for reasons that would echo later in the 80s and 90s, that they had a sense of national pride. He said, and I quote, "It's impossible to dream of a voluntary agreement between us and the Arabs, not now and not in the foreseeable future. They see it as their land, their national home, and no nation will willingly consent to new landlords or even to partnership." So said Jabotinsky already in the late 1920s, and that he was right. Turns out, in retrospect, Jabotinsky was right about the British, about the Arabs, and about the fate of European Jews. The three issues that he made his main foci during his active years, he was completely right about, and therefore he was a hated figure because no one wanted to hear it. He said, "Only an iron wall of Jewish bayonets would force the Arabs to accept the inevitable." That was the third approach. There was a fourth approach. Today we'd consider them complete peaceniks. They're having a revival today, the binationalists. Judah Magnus, who was the president of Hebrew University, and the philosopher Martin Buber. They founded a movement called Brit Shalom. It is what it sounds like, the peace covenant. Just to settle with the Arabs, live with the Arabs together, let there be an Arab state. They would be of a similar mind, of a different background than Hashomer HaTzair, who are pacifists, who would abandon the Jewish state. Now the quotas of the 20s and the early 30s, of course, were a two-edged sword. The various groups vied with each other over who would fulfill the quota. Ben-Gurion and Weizmann wanted socialist types, farmers, workers, especially no one religious, and this was not hidden. This became a major controversy. Jabotinsky wanted anybody. The Mizrahi in the 1920s brought in religious Polish Jews who weren't farmers but were merchants, and they built factories, they opened stores, they even speculated in land. They were not the Jews that Weizmann Ben-Gurion wanted. Jabotinsky wanted anybody. Throughout the 20s and 30s, there was a strenuous competition between all the groups to bring in those who would be supporters, who would strengthen their political power, and to keep out those who would strengthen their rivals. Now, with that, with those limitations, as well as the fact that there's always significant yirida in the 20s and 30s, so the numbers stayed lower than it was. Agav Urchah, in the mid-1920s, the old Yishuv, which, as we noted last week, after the assassination of Dahan, was basically marginalized as a political player in these affairs, the old Yishuv was replenished by the arrival of Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, Rosh Yeshiva in Kletsk, the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, Zatzal, by the altar of Slobodko, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, and Rosh Yeshiva, Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who came, moved the Slobodko Yeshiva to Hebron, and then after the massacre in 1929, they reconstituted the Slobodka Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, but with a new name. Now the Hebron Yeshiva, which of course still exists until today. Rav Kook in 1923 founded what he called the Merkaz HaYeshiva Olamit, the Universal Yeshiva known as Merkaz HaRav today. Numerous Olim came from East Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, under the auspices of Poal HaMizrahi and Poal Agudat Yisrael. Strange as it sounds to our ears, they were religious socialists, so they were a little novelty even to the secular socialists. But they established their own kibbutzim. Many of them exist today, although Poal HaMizrahi, I think it might just be on a letterhead. And I certainly can tell that Poal Agudat Yisrael just exists on a letterhead with the president. But as organizations, they had some role in the 20s and 30s, and thereafter establishing kibbutzim and moshavim, but their day has long passed. Now the immigration yo-yo all depended on who was in power. In 1930, the Shaw Commission blamed the 1929 riots on the Arabs, but they concluded that the only way to diffuse tensions was to restrict Jewish immigration to a maximum of 50,000 Jews. So right away, when these things happened, especially Jabotinsky was the leader in illegal immigration, but ways were found to subvert the official agencies. But the British were constantly analyzing and investigating and reevaluating, and each new government, each new minister for that matter, had a different plan, a different study, and a different commission trying to deal with this problem. The most honest of them was probably Lord Passfield. In October of 1930, he was the colonial secretary. He issued the Passfield White Paper, which almost explicitly negated the Balfour Declaration. And he said the land could not absorb more people. More Jews would just cause more strife. So he basically renounced it. He did not care much for Jews, nor his wife. She uttered this gem to Weizmann after the Hebron massacre. Imagine I'm speaking in a British accent now. I can't understand why Jews make such a fuss over a few dozen of their people killed in Palestine. As many are killed every week in London in traffic accidents, and no one pays any attention. That was her analysis of the problems in Israel. Well, feeling betrayed by the British, and Weizmann had been the greatest advocate of the British, he resigned his leadership position in the Zionist organization in 1930, And then, because of internal politics, was not reelected in 1931 after he hinted at support for a Magnus-type binational state. And that lost him even those who had been his erstwhile supporters. He was replaced by Nachum Sokolov. But just as well, because Weizmann never fully understood the gravity of the struggle ahead. He tolerated the British because he also naively advocated that the Jewish state must, and I quote, come into existence without violating the legitimate interests of the Arabs. Not a hair on their head shall be touched. The Arabs have the same right to their homes here as we have to our national home. Well, that was his opinion. It didn't impress the Arabs. Certainly didn't have the effect on the British he thought it would. Didn't impress the Jews either. Weizmann would never again play the leading power role that he had before, although he would be a major symbol of the Jews in the 30s and 40s, and a spokesman as well, and a very important supporting player. Meanwhile, Jabotinsky, who had resigned from the Zionist movement in 1925, now came back as the Jewish agency guaranteed representation for the deviationist movements, including the non-socialists. But when the 1931 Zionist Congress explicitly rejected his proposal to define the aim of Zionism as the establishment of a Jewish state, used those words, rather than Jewish national home, Jewish homeland. Those words were rejected, establishment of a Jewish state. He again went his own way, and I mean his own way, in terms of immigration, in terms of economic policy, in terms of foreign policy. He traveled throughout Europe and the world in the 30s, not just because of the crisis that was developing, but to gather support for his vision of the future Jewish state, and especially in terms of self-defense. Establishing in 1931 the Irgun Tzva'i Lumi, the Etzel, co-founded with Avram Tahomi. You remember from last week he was the deputy commander of the Haganah in Yerushalayim, who late in life admitted to commanding the assassination of Yaakov Dahan. So the Etzel then would be a rival military force to the Haganah, and in fact would undertake its own defense policy as well, as we'll see shortly. Now, there are many rivalries. All these rivalries, again, undermine the Jewish cause from within because we never spoke with a unified voice. And different countries and diplomats could appeal to different parts of the Jewish world for support, and there really wasn't one voice speaking on behalf of the Jews. Now, Jabotinsky began to apply economic pressure as well as political pressure on the British, and it paid off because the British retreated from the Passfield White Paper, which had renounced Balfour, and in the early 30s essentially reinstated Balfour. British Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald liberalized immigration quotas, and the 30s became a banner decade. 30,000 per year came. In 1934, almost 45,000 Jews. In 1935, almost 65,000 Jews. And the demographic balance began to shift dramatically in the Jews' favor. This was especially fortuitous as the Nazi rise to power created a new dynamic with which the Jews had to deal. Now, thousands of German Jews came to Israel also in the 1930s. And one etymology of the word Yeki relates exactly to that, that they came with their jackets, Yeki being a jacket, and they refused to adopt the garb of the new Yishuv, which one writer says was as meaningful to them as the Bekesha was to the old Yishuv, a bare head, a wearing shorts, and an open neck shirt, sometimes open to the waist. That was the garb of the old of the new Yishuv. Old Yishuv had its black and white. Arayom they have that. The Yekis came with their Yekis. They wore their jackets with their old world manners. They brought their punctiliousness with them. They became professors and doctors and lawyers and merchants. And as we know, Ladavonenu, usually clerks and bureaucrats, known for their efficiency, if not for their officiousness as well. By the way, this has nothing to do with the German colony, which was founded by German Protestants in the late 19th century. They were pro-German, so pro-German that by 1939 they were mostly gone because they were pro-German, pro-German government, whoever the government happened to be. Now, the Depression, of course, affected the Yeshiva greatly, as can be imagined. America and Europe plunged into economic turmoil. Banks failed. The persecution of Jews stepped up in the Soviet Union, while in Germany, the Nazis became the leading party in the Reichstag already in 1931, although the President Hindenburg refused to appoint Hitler the Chancellor until 1933. He considered him a buffoon, but others did as well. Nonetheless, he became more than that. Already, though, in 1931, Jews were beaten on the streets of Berlin, and Jews struggled and argued over what approach to take. So many left. We see many German Jews already came in the 20s and 30s. Some Jews, in retrospect, naively wrote to Hitler, wrote letters which are still extant, explaining to him that they're always good Germans and he has a wrong conception of Jews and he should protect them because they'll be good citizens. Some advocated boycotts of German goods to get their attention. Other Jews opposed the boycott of German products, notably Moreno Yaakov Rosenheim, who's the head of World Agudas Yisrael, who's a German Jew, who said the boycott would make matters worse for local Jews. In that sense, he was correct. It would make matters worse for local Jews. Not boycotting the Germans would also make matters worse for local Jews. The problem, we'll see this next week also in dealing with this time, is that no one really had any conception. Even if people spoke about it, no one really could imagine the extent of the horrors that awaited. The most ominous and really the most prescient of all was Jabotinsky, who literally went throughout Europe in the 1930s warning Jews of the disaster that's going to befall them, saying Europe is a graveyard, and he pleaded in country after country for Jews to leave. And he himself stepped up illegal immigration to Israel during the time. In response, he was accused of being a fearmonger and a fascist, and he was further alienated from mainstream Zionism. Now, this is also a pattern that exists in Jewish life. Nobody wants to hear bad news. And then when bad things happen, people say, why don't you speak about it a little more? The answer is that no one wants to hear it. No one wants to hear it then, and it's no different today or even in the 90s. It's just people want to live in with a rosier scenario in mind. Now, Jabotinsky's alienation and the feud within the Zionist movement really came to a head with the Arlozorov affair. Chaim Arlozorov was born in 1899, also in Romny in the Ukraine, like Pinchas Rutenberg had been. But he left early. He left as a child in 1905. He was 6 years old. After the pogroms, his family moved to Berlin, and he was raised in Berlin. He became a Zionist. He became a leader of Mapai, Miflegat Pa'alei Yisrael, which was Ben-Gurion's party. In the late 1920s, he assumed a very powerful position as the head of the political department of the Jewish Agency. In effect, he was a rival to Ben-Gurion. In 1933, in that capacity, Arlozorov was sent to Germany to negotiate with the Nazis what was called the Ha'avara, the transfer agreement. And he was able to successfully complete an agreement. The Nazis would let as many Jews as wanted to leave, on condition they could not take their property with them, but their money would be placed in a special account that would be used to purchase German goods for delivery to Israel for use when they would arrive. So for the Nazis, Yimach Shemom, it was a good deal. They got rid of the Jews, but they benefited from Jewish money, and they especially frustrated any type of boycott, because it was the Jews themselves that were buying from them. For the Jews, it was a good deal as well, because they got money, and during the Depression, they got the use of needed capital as well. So it seemed like a good deal. He returned to Israel June 14, 1933, with an elevated status. 2 days later, it was a Friday night, June 16, 1933, he was walking with his wife on the beach in Tel Aviv, and he was shot to death, killed. Now this unleashed a major storm, and it will begin a pattern that would last for 75 years and really hasn't ended until today. The Lazarev affair still reverberates in Israeli life. Blame was ascribed to right-wing extremists and was used to cast aspersions on the revisionist movement. Three revisionists were arrested immediately. One was Abba Achimeir, who was an ideologue. He was accused of plotting the assassination. Incidentally, he's the father of Yaakov Achimeir. If you know Israel TV, is a broadcaster, a newsreader. He has one of the political shows at night. Charged with murder were Tzvi Rosenblatt and Avram Stavsky. Now, at the trial, Achimeir and Rosenblatt were acquitted. Stavsky was convicted of murder, and he was sentenced to hang until dead. Now, it's unleashed a storm and a fog as well. Apparently, Arlozorov, before he died, had said that no Jew had done it. Yet his wife had identified the two Jews. Meanwhile, two Arabs confessed. Rav Kook, who was already suffering from cancer, was vociferous and unyielding in his defense of Stavsky, having received confidential information that Stavsky was not the murderer, and so he became the leading defender of Stavsky, going out on the limb against the establishment, against the Jewish agency, against the British, against the Jewish local leaders, mobilizing world opinion against what he said was a blood libel. Stavsky was a very simple person, not a religious Jew. In August of 1934, he wrote to Rav Kook a tearful letter. I saw the letter. You could tell he had a very pure neshama and a very sweet soul, Stavsky. He said he doesn't understand why he merited the invention of the Gadol Hador, that he's just a simple Jew. But he asked Rav Kook to daven for him, and he said, I believe in the power of your prayers. And he said he may not have always fulfilled his obligations to the Ribono Shel Olam, but at least he was always Mechaved Av V'Aim, and if Rav Kook could look after his parents. In the end, due to a number of circumstances, including Rav Kook's pressure and the lack of any corroborating evidence, the High Court of Appeals reversed the verdict, and Stavsky was cleared and freed. Nebuch, 14 years later, he was killed on the Alta Lena. It's as if the Malach HaMavos was following him around, trying to involve him in one controversy to the next. But Arlozorov's murder had many consequences, some that linger until today. The murder was used by the left to besmirch the right. Ben-Gurion took advantage of this to castigate Jabotinsky and his fascist thugs, his term, who have no rightful place in Israel. The revisionists were put on the defensive, condemned by the media, and they lost significant influence at a time when their ideas, especially relating to saving Jews from Europe and building defenses against the Arabs, were especially needed, lost so much influence that in the Zionist elections 1 month later, well, let's put it like this, in the earlier elections in 1931, a coalition of Jabotinsky and the religious parties and the breakaway from Weizmann achieved their highest level, 43% of the vote, and the tide was shifting in their direction. In this election, Labor got 43%, and the revisionists fell to 16%. Not only that, but Arlozorov became a shorthand in Israeli life for political assassination used as a weapon against the right. As in, going back now to 1995, which we'll visit again in a few months, Shamir, 2 weeks before Rabin was killed, said to Netanyahu that his sources in the intelligence world, and we'll see Shamir was a Mossadnik in the 50s, said that, I quote, they're planning another Arlozorov. And everybody knew what he meant. A murder that will be blamed on the right wing. That was one consequence. There's another consequence. Jabotinsky gained a new respect for religious figures and the role of religion in the Jewish state, which really later paved the way for the smooth relations between, say, his successor parties, like the Likud, and the religious parties. He wrote a letter to Rav Kook after Stavsky was cleared, saying that the nation and its youth will never forget your outcry which revealed anew the strength of Jewish tradition, and he saw how the weight of a gadol b'Torah could add to the moral posture and majesty of the Jewish nation. And that became something that he would also speak about in the few years remaining before his died, before he died. By the way, July 8th, 1934, right after Stopsky was released from prison, the first Shabbos he went to the great synagogue in Yerushalayim, wasn't great as then as it is today. When he was called to the Torah, apparently the laborites knew he was coming, so thugs started to attack him and people in shul, and a melee broke out during davening. People were beaten, benches were broken, police had to be called to restore order. That's how much the society was split by this case. Now, to his credit, Ben-Gurion in 1934 tried to negotiate a settlement with Jabotinsky, was brokered by Pinchas Rutenberg, relating to just internal peace and harmony, and especially labor issues. The key issue was, could you have workers who would not be members of the Histadrut? Remember, Jabotinsky favored a capitalist free enterprise system. Also, they should be able to focus on saving Jews. They agreed. They came to an agreement, but unfortunately, the socialist radicals in the Zionist organization voted it down by 60%, led by Yitzhak Tabenki, who was a famous figure. He said, we'll have no agreement with pro-capitalists. He did not want to allow non-Histadrut workers anywhere in Israel to retain control. That agreement went by the boards, and eventually there was a greater split between the revisionists and the labor. Now, who did kill Arlozorov? Well, that is an unsolved mystery. There are many theories. When Begin became the prime minister, so he had an interest in revisiting this matter, a government commission was formed in 1982. They found that the revisionists were unequivocally innocent of any involvement. They were exonerated, but there was no conclusive finding as to who was involved. There are persistent rumors. Now, I mentioned last week about Dahan is really confirmed. There were rumors also extant in the 70s and 80s that the Haganah was again involved. If you just look at who had the most to gain from Arlozorov's death, it would be the one who succeeded Weizmann as the head of the movement, and that would be Ben-Gurion. Blame the right, ascend to power, and so he had the most to gain. And it's not always pure equation, but usually when someone dies, the one who has the most to gain is the murderer. It's not always like that because people don't always act rationally, but nonetheless, that's a theory. There were two Arabs who did confess in the early 1940s. Another two Arabs confessed and said that it was just a failed robbery attempt, and it wasn't at all political, but apparently they got some of the details wrong, and then it's unclear why they wouldn't have killed her also if it's a robbery attempt. The wildest of all theories was only published first a few years ago in an Israeli magazine. I only say this because it's out there. It's interesting. Remember that Arlozorov had grown up in Berlin. His sister became very friendly, with a German girl named Magda Behrendt. Magda Behrendt, throughout the 1920s, carried on an affair with Chaim Arlozorov whenever he would visit Berlin, which was a Zionist center at the time. She divorced in 1929. In fact, her mother married a Jew who was later killed in Buchenwald. In June 1933, Arlozorov returned to Berlin to negotiate with the Nazis, and while he was there, he resumed his liaison with the Magda, who had now remarried, and her last name was Goebbels, as in the wife of Joseph Goebbels, who was a rising star in the Nazi party, would eventually become minister of propaganda. When he found out, so he feared that his career would be ruined if it was learned that his wife was having an affair with a Jew. So as soon as Arlozorov returned to Israel, he had him killed, the Nazis having agents in Israel as well through those who lived in the German colony. Now, it's a theory, it's as good as any other theory. Of course, he couldn't have him killed in Germany because that would be a diplomatic incident, and these things, Israel itself was always a place of much tension and rivalry amongst Jews, so it would stand to reason that it would be blamed against someone, not him. But that theory is out there anyway. The affair was more important, the Arlozorov affair, for what it meant then and historically as a weapon against the right, and it certainly soured the atmosphere for decades after that. Just a word about the religious life in the 30s. There was a changing of the guard. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld died on the 19th of Adar Beis in 1932. He succeeded as Rav of Yerushalayim, really Rav of the Old Yishuv, by Rav Yosef Tzvi Dushinsky. But they never again had the same influence. In fact, after Dahan was killed, didn't have the same influence. Rav Kook died just a short time later, 3 years later, the 3rd of Elul, 1935. He was eventually succeeded as chief rabbi by the chief rabbi of Ireland, Rav Yitzhak Herzog. And in 1933, Rav Kook was instrumental in bringing in, through a special waiver, a Lithuanian gadol by the name of Rav Yeshaya Karolitz, better known to us as the Chazon Ish. He moved to Bnei Brak. He established Bnei Brak as a leading religious community, and he of course became the leading authority of the old Yishuv. And the Chazon Ish pioneered new approaches to Shabbos observance, to Shemitah observance in the modern world, all in line with modern technology. 1 year later, his brother-in-law came, Yaakov Kanievsky, known as the Stipler Gaon, and he would be a dominant figure in the next 50 years. One other vignette, in the spring of 1935, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik makes his only visit to the land of Israel. Another interesting tale, he came to apply for the job as chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He was invited to apply, he took a ship, took 2 weeks to get there, and in true Israeli fashion, by the time he landed, they had given the job already to someone else, to the chief rabbi of Antwerp, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. Now Rav Kook, the Rav spent 6-7 weeks in the land of Israel, including Shavuos. If you want to know whether he held 1 day or 2 days, that's a good question. It's a good machlokes. But the reports are that he did no melacha on the second day of Yom Tov while he was there. He met Rav Kook, who was ailing then with cancer. He gave a shiur in Merkaz, as a matter of fact. And after Rav Kook met him, and Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap spent time with him, they said, I felt I was again in the presence of his grandfather, Rav Chaim, because this Volozhin and Bris came alive again. So although Rabbi Soloveitchik was suggested as a candidate for chief rabbi after Herzog died in 1959, he declined to be a candidate, and he would never again return to Israel. Now, there was a similar feature in the 30s, as in the 20s, and that was constant riots. What we'd call today sporadic terrorism. Jews would be killed, bombs would go off, not on a regular basis, but enough that they lived always with the specter of Arab violence. Arab violence, though, paled before the dangers in Europe. More than 110,000 Jews came to Israel in 1934-35 alone. Now 30% of the population. In fact, those were the two middle years of what was called the Fifth Aliyah. The Fifth Aliyah brought in almost 200,000 Jews, spurred after 1935 by the Nuremberg Laws, by the Nazi unrest, and this in the main provoked what became known as the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 1939. Again, there were a wave of riots and pogroms. The Arabs, led by Haj Amin al-Husseini, Yimach Shemovitz Zichro, called first a general strike. They blew up the oil pipeline that brought in oil from Iraq to Haifa. They attacked railroads, attacked settlements. The Haganah, now 10,000 strong, came into its own, together with British police, but they only responded, and we'll get back to that in a moment. Now the Haganah formed a special unit called the Special Night Squads, which was a joint British-Jewish force trained by famous figure Ord Wingate, who was a Christian Zionist, the British military officer, a Christian Zionist, a Protestant who believed very strongly, as many evangelicals do today, that the Jewish state has to exist for Christian religious reasons. And he was a philo Jew. He loved Jews and he loved Israel. And he was assigned to Israel as a intelligence officer The British soon realized that he was compromised because he loved Israel too much. So he took it upon himself to train this special unit. Now Wingate trained them in tactics which became the basic order of the IDF for the next 50 years. Preemptive strikes, small mobile commando units that would be used for ambushes. So he trained them. The unit was commanded by Yitzhak Sadeh, and he was tasked with a particular mission. Oh, this sounds very familiar, because nothing changes in the world. He had to stop terror. He had to stop the ongoing terror. Now, Wingate was a bit of a strange duck. Some stories I can't even tell in shul, but he was not above torture to achieve his means. Some of what he did, he would have prisoners to get them to talk. He would shoot every 10th man dead until he got the others to talk. He would hold prisoners' head in oil in order to get them to talk. And he said, and I quote, "War and weapons aren't pure." Now, his tactics, of course, were renounced by others. Eventually, he himself was removed by the British when, back in Britain, he advocated openly a Jewish state, which was certainly not necessarily appropriate coming from an active military officer, but beyond that, it opposed the government policy. So he was not only recalled from Israel, but he was banned. His passport was stamped, not allowed to enter Palestine. He was later killed in Burma, fighting for the British in World War II. By a strange coincidence, I read, he's buried in Arlington National Cemetery because his plane crashed in Burma and the remains of the passengers were unidentifiable, and by military custom, they go by the rove. And if the rove of the passengers were a certain nationality, you're buried in that country. So the rove were Americans. So the whole lot of them were buried in Arlington. Among the figures that Wingate trained and brought into these special night squads were later great military figures, Yigal Alon, Moshe Dayan. They received his training from Wingate. Wingate, of course, the Machon Wingate, the sports institute south of Netanya, is named for him. Then 3 years of the Arab Revolt, 415 Jews were killed, 5,000 Arabs were killed. Now, what's important to know is that they were not necessarily killed because of offensive actions on the part of the Haganah or the British. The special night squads were a little different. They were much more aggressive, and certainly the Irgun was. The Jewish agency adopted a policy of what they called havlaga, restraint, that they would not respond to every attack. And that is a very bizarre policy that exists ad hayom. When Sharon spent 2 years in the early 2000s not responding to terror, that's what he referred to. When Olmert does not respond to even today to rocket attacks, he says we're following the policy of havlaga. Strange as it sounds, Netanya was a terrorist attack today, a suicide bombing in Eilat that killed 3 Jews, and the defense minister, Amir Peretz, hard to say that without laughing and crying, but Peretz announced that they are suspending the policy of Havlaga in Gaza to strike out against terror against Gaza. Now, why any self-respecting government would maintain such a policy of not responding to hostilities is bizarre. Jabotinsky said it forced Jews to act like cowards. David Raziel, who was the commander of the Irgun, rejected it completely, and the Etzel began a practice of responding to every civilian attack by attacking Arab civilians, saying Arabs only understand strength, which, by the way, is again a refrain you hear constantly in the right wing in Israel ad hayom. In all told, 60 attacks at all. In fact, that's how the revolt started. On April 15, 1936, the Arabs declared a general strike and punctuated it by killing 3 Jewish road workers. The very next day, the Irgun killed 3 Arab workers in Yafo. And whenever there was a bomb, they bombed. The most deadly one, July 28, 1938, 53 Arabs were killed in the Shuk in Haifa by a bomb planted by the Irgun. February 27, 1939, 33 Arabs were killed by bombs placed in markets in the Haifa and Yerushalayim. The Jewish agency condemned the Irgun. That also became a pattern that would recur in the 40s. Whatever one says about the morality, the bottom line is that it worked. And eventually the revolt ended and the attacks on Jews ended as well. Nobody likes to think about it, but there was a wave of terror in the early 80s, and you may remember the emergence of a Jewish underground. One of the acts that they did was they blew off the legs of six Arab mayors, and many were arrested and sent to prison, people that we know also, and it was widely condemned, but it also stopped the terror for 6 years. So whatever one says about the morality, it's a dirty business. Now, the Arab revolt had another unintended consequence. The Jewish economy was forced to separate from the Arab economy. Couldn't use the port in Yafo. They had to build a port in Tel Aviv. Had to build a port in Tel Aviv, and Haifa, and Ashdod, Ashdod came later, in order to market their products. They had to find new markets, how to get only Jewish workers, how to manufacture their own food products and grow their own produce, how to build their own industrial zones. And of course, all this was of tremendous benefit later because it made the yeshuv more self-sufficient. With the violence raging in the land of Israel, the British in 1937 formed another commission under Lord William Peel called the Peel Commission. They realized the mandate was spiraling out of control. They held hearings to resolve, once and for all, the Palestine problem. Now, of course, the Jews couldn't agree. Magnus renounced the idea of a Jewish state. Every Jew wanted to testify before the commission. Judah Magnus renounced the idea of a Jewish state. He said he would favor even a halt to Jewish immigration, if only there'd be peace. Weizmann said, words he would probably live to regret, Israel cannot absorb 6 million Jews. And he said, what in retrospect sounds very cold, 2 millions of youth with their lives before them, they'll come. The old ones, he meant the ones in Europe, will pass. They are dust in a cruel world. Only a remnant will survive. We have to accept it. And this was the specter of World War II looming. Ben-Gurion said, immigration comes before peace, that the Jews of Poland and Germany have no other choice. Now, if you look at the handout, there's a beautiful vignette from the end of Ben-Gurion's testimony. As you see, he was asked by Lord Peel, where are you from? And Ben-Gurion said, Plansk. Where is Plansk? In Poland. Lord Peel, that is very strange. All the Arab witnesses who appeared before this commission, Nuseiba, Nasabiba, Altal, Al-Husseini, Hazanin Al-Husseini, were born here in Palestine. And almost all the Jewish witnesses who appeared before us were not born here. You say that this is your home, but someone else lives here now, the Arabs. There's an international law which states that if somebody contests the right of someone who is holding onto property, he must submit documentary proof of ownership, a kushan, that the property belongs to him even though he was not born there. Ben-Gurion lifted the Bible, that's what he put the oath on, and said, Lord Peel, surely we have a kushan. This is our kushan, the Bible. The British are a nation that respects the Bible. Is our historical right, as stated in the Bible, less authentic than a document penned by some clerk in some land registry office? This is an everlasting document in which it is written, to your children I've given this land. God promised this land to our father Abraham and to his descendants. There's no doubt that we are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So said Ben-Gurion. You see, he's on a little higher madrega than some of his successors. Ben-Gurion also said something else that you may recall became very popular in 2004-2005. He said that they would agree to partition, but he said, no Jew living has the right to renounce any part of the land of Israel. It's not ours to renounce. It's given to us by God, by the Bible, and it's not the right of any Jew. It's the right of the Jewish people in every generation. There's a sequel to this. Rav Lau, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, is a former chief rabbi, writes, that he visited Ben-Gurion at Zde Boker in 1973, shortly before Ben-Gurion died. And he asked him, is this story true? And Ben-Gurion said, MS Yatsiv. It's completely true, word for word, as you've heard it. So Rav Lau then asked Ben-Gurion, well, what if someone would take their deed to their house and tear it up, or crumple it up, or cut out parts of it, so that it's unrecognizable from the deed? Meaning that you claim the Torah is the deed, but the Torah says many things. It's tired mitzvahs from the Torah. So how do you renounce the mitzvahs of the Torah and then claim the Torah is the deed? And he said Ben-Gurion was a very smart man and he refused to answer the question. But that's the end of the story. In July of 1937, Lord Peel recommended the partition of Israel. You see the map in front of you, the lighter areas, the Jewish states. The Jewish state basically running from the Galil to the coastal plain, excluding Yafo, and that's about it. 4% of the original mandate, and the Jewish agency reluctantly accepted this. The Arabs, enraged that any size Jewish state would be contemplated, rejected it, also a pattern that would repeat itself, and they stepped up the violence. In fact, the Arab League was formed now for the specific purpose of preventing a Jewish state. Many Jews opposed the partition, including famous Americans, Felix Warburg, the financier, Otto Sulzberger, the publisher of the Times, and Martin Buber as well, because they were against the Jewish state for their own reasons. Others saw it as a betrayal. If settlement and immigration are the key, then you could never settle Jews such a small piece of land. Weizmann said they should accept the state, even if the size is that of a tablecloth. All right, he had a good way with words. Nonetheless, it was rejected, and when it was rejected, immigration was frozen again down to less than 10,000 per year. And so when the Jews most needed a haven, Israel was close to them, although 5 to 6 times as many Arabs would be able to enter the land of Israel. Now, to show you what the times were like, the Jerusalem Post started publishing in 1932. So I have a copy of the book published a few years ago, the front page of the Jerusalem Post. May 17, 1936, at the beginning of the hostilities, the headline in the Palestine Post was, 3 Shot Dead in Jerusalem Cinema. People sat down to watch a movie, Motzoi Shabbos, in the Edison Theater Yerushalayim, and an Arab walked in and just started shooting. 5 shots, 3 people were killed. And the editorial that day in the Palestine Post was entitled, War of Extermination. That is, this what the Arabs want? After the cold-blooded triple murder in the Edison Hall last night, all Jews must ask themselves, whose turn is it next? For no Jew, however sheltered, is now safe. Be he a Jew bent on a pious errand in the old city, or one who seeks relaxation in a cinema house, the assassin's bullet is there waiting for him. If this is a war of extermination the Arabs have declared on the Jews, the Arabs had better know that the shooting down of 400,000 Jews will not alter the course of history, will not shake the Jews' determination to resettle the land of their fathers. By the end, let every man with a spark of humanity now pray that it is not yet too late to turn back the tide. You could write that editorial tomorrow, by the way, with the same ending, with the Jews still hoping that maybe now the Arabs will come to the senses, they'll get it out of their system. November 9th, 1938, this is after the Evian Conference decides that the Jews really have no place to go, the Jewish refugees, Britain doesn't want them in Israel. The new Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, declares that the solution in Palestine is impracticable. There is just no answer. Later that night, Kristallnacht erupts across Germany. May 17, 1939, a scant 7 months later, Chamberlain issues a white paper, the famous white paper. Only 75,000 more Jews will be allowed in the land of Israel over the next 5 years. And then Jews can immigrate only with the explicit permission of the Arabs. Within 10 years, there'll be an Arab state, not a Jewish state. And again, the Jerusalem Post quotes the response of the Jewish agency rejecting it and nonetheless fearing for the consequences of the Jews of Europe. With the Chamberlain White Paper, the abandonment of Balfour was complete. The Zionist organization, reeling from this still, trying to come to terms with it, met in August in Geneva, debated how to proceed. As they were meeting, word came of the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement, the non-aggression pact between the Soviets and the Nazis, which essentially guaranteed the start of World War II. In a few days, the dismemberment of Poland, very famous picture taken of the leaders of the Zionist Congress, Ben-Gurion and others, sitting literally with their heads in their hands, overcome by grief, knowing that the fate of European Jews was now sealed. When war breaks out the following week, Ben-Gurion says, famously, "We must fight Hitler as though there were no white paper, and fight the white paper as though there were no Hitler." How that would come to pass and how well they would fare, how poorly they would fare, so we'll see next week. But there's no doubt that with all the internecine struggles and all the difficulties and the hostility of the world, you have to say in retrospect that in the 30s, the Jewish leaders failed the challenge, and the unprecedented horror of the Holocaust, as well as the rebirth of the Jewish state, awaited in the 1940s. I thank you very much. So next week, we'll discuss the 1940s.